As we start in this, I want us to start off with a discussion about Christians in the world, and then we'll move for a prayer time. And you're in these little groups. So those of you who are newcomers amongst us, these discussions are pretty important. A key thing is to get to know who else is in the group. Part of the process is every time you come each week, there's a different bunch of people to sit with. And so you gradually get to know more and more people as you come along each week with us. But each night we have some discussions, and this is the one that we're doing here at the moment. As a Christian, are there things that your non-Christian friends do or say that you shouldn't do or say? You're a Christian in the world. The world is doing things. Are there things that you shouldn't be doing? Or things that you do as a Christian, are there things that you do that your non-Christian friends disapprove of? It goes both ways, doesn't it? Because some non-Christians have a moral value system that is critical of the Christian value system. So that's why. And then how do a Christian's goals in life differ from a non-Christian's? Okay, let's give it a break here for a moment. I'll collect up some answers. Okay, different language. What about you guys? Excessive drinking, yeah, okay. Drug use, yes. Philosophically, bigger than just drugs and drink, yep. Gossiping. Okay, I'm going to move to the second question. Political stance, that we have political stance that non-Christian friends disapprove of.
Over evangelism, so inviting people to church and wanting to talk to them about the gospel.
Going to things like church, ministry and forums. Volunteering for, yeah.
Preaching and living out the gospel.
Okay, that brings that the third question for you guys. Our goals are not about career.
Our lives as Christians are revolving around Jesus. It's all about themselves.
Much less materialistic, all right, yeah?
Part of a Christian's goal is actually to serve God.
Yes, very different orientation to our lives, isn't it? Okay, we're going to spend some time now in prayer. We're going to pray together in our little groups. One important thing about learning to pray, and each time we'll be teaching more about learning to pray, is learning how to pray together. That is, three fundamental practices of good behaviour in prayer groups. You need to be audible, brief, and concrete. Audible, ABC, that's a very simple thing, isn't it? The audible, brief, one sentence. God our Father, He knows what we mean, He knows what we do. So we need to pray about these things. Russia and Ukraine, that's a real problem in life at the moment, isn't it? COVID, churches opening up again. I don't know about your church, but I've been going to churches that have, you know, been online for ages. I've been to churches where, but this Sunday we can sing without masks on. Yay, that's it. The thing I've missed most about the last 2 years is not singing. That's the bit that I feel the most I've missed out on. I don't know about you. Student work at universities, of course, many of them are just starting up and trying to find people, and it's difficult in the COVID time as well. Pick an overseas missionary. You've got a friend that you should be praying for. Pray for them. The others don't know the missionary. That's all right. They'll know at the end of your prayer. And then pray for Forum tonight. Ready, set, go. Tonight we're going to be looking at religious philosophy tensions about the world. How are we to live in the world? And I'm suggesting the topic for tonight is actually that Christians are ambivalent about the world. Who can tell me quickly what ambivalent means? Undecided, yes, in a sense, but no, it's simpler than that. The word means two-minded, really. Two wills. And so I want it and I don't want it. I like it and I don't like it. Do I love the world? Is it good for Christians to love the world, or shouldn't we love the world? See, there's my question for you right now. God loved the world. Should we? Should we love the world? Okay. Now, one of the great things about Forum is it's great to make mistakes. Learning comes from making mistakes. That's why I know so much. Spent my life making mistakes, you see. Mind you can make mistakes and learn nothing, but that's an idiot, right? Making mistakes and learning from your mistakes is the way to go. And I'm very keen for you to make mistakes. So we're going to have a show of hands now. The question is, it's either a yes or no. So hands up those who think we should love the world. Hands up those who think we shouldn't love the world. So as a group we're ambivalent, and we've got a few people who are handless amongst us. Don't know who they are, but you see, what does the Bible say? John 3:16, God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. I mean, you can't love something much more than give your own son. God passionately, deeply, profoundly loves the world. He so loved the world. But 1 John 2:15, do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father is not in them. So God loves the world and we shouldn't love the world. Well, no, that doesn't really work, actually, because we should do as God does. So we're really stuck now. This is what I mean about ambivalence, you see. We're two-minded about it. How much should I be involved in the affairs of the world? And how much should I withdraw from the affairs of the world and have nothing to do with the world? So I am hearing a ding-dong, ding-dong, Angus. Is that...
That's not you. That,
oh, I see. I just thought there was someone over there shaking their head. However, ding, dong. So I want us to look at certain dimensions, certain kind of spectrums, if you like, of belief, of attitude towards the world. And we'll look at it in this graphical form as we look at these two axes that we may have. There's a spectrum of views, for example, between asceticism and hedonism. They're the opposite of each other, the opposite end of the spectrum. There are some Christians who are very keen to be ascetic. There are some Christians who actually write books on being hedonistic. Or there are people who believe in spirituality, and there are other people who believe in materialism. Now, to help you grasp what it is that I mean by these terms, although I'm just picking on a dictionary, here are the terms that they mean. See, asceticism is denying sensual pleasure. A person who doesn't eat anything but the most basic of foods and tries to eat as little as possible and live out in the desert by themselves, all sensual pleasure. Whereas the hedonist is the exact opposite. They have a pursuit of sensual pleasure. That's what life is all about. Have as much pleasure for your senses as is possible. People with spirituality are devoted to the non-material world and existence and experiences because they think that only spiritual things matter. In fact, some of them, like the Hare Krishna, I don't know if you ever see Hare Krishnas around, they believe that the physical world doesn't exist at all. It's just an imagination. They call it Maya. It's a deception. It's the devil's deception that there is a physical world because there's only spiritual things. It's a fairly extreme version, although Christian Science teaches much the same, that the physical world doesn't exist, which means when you get sick, you really are deceived because you haven't got a body to be sick with. So you just think and read Mary Baker Eddy and you'll get better. And then there's materialism, the other end of it, isn't it? That is, the acquiring of possessions is what really matters. And whoever has the most when they die wins. Because for them, there is no spiritual, there is nothing, there's only matter. That's all there is. Whatever matter might be, energy particles or whatever you bring it down, that's all that exists. So there's four kinds of views along spectrums, aren't they? Now, some people are right out the end of one of these views. So asceticism. You'll get some who are... They deny all physical pleasure. You know, you live with goat's hair clothing, you lie on a bed of nails, you live out in the extremes. Here's one, a book that came out some many years ago now about the death of a guru by Rabbi Maharaj. And he was an Indian in West Indies. His father was a guru. For 8 years, his father didn't move. For 8 years, his father didn't speak. For 8 years, his father didn't wash. People washed him. People dressed him. People gave food to him, force feeding him. He just lived like a god, an idol, a statue for 8 years, you see, with no communication or anybody. And people treated him as the god. They treated him as a guru. They treated him as one who had fully enlightened and entered nirvana. And then he died. And at that point, Rabbi's whole world collapsed. and he had to rethink his Hinduism and rethink what life is about, and has become a Christian and written several books. This is the first of the books that he's written about his experience. But there is an extreme form of asceticism, a denial of all sensuality, of all senses, of all pleasures. Just, you don't exist. But you can't just put one person on one dimension, can you? Because that man was also into spirituality. It was Hindu spiritualism together with asceticism. And so, in a sense, with the graph, you really have to put him in that kind of quadrant. He's a spiritual ascetic, right? And these different kind of philosophies, religions, views of life, etc., can be placed in different areas. I mean, you could be a materialistic hedonist. I'll give you an example of that. The Marquis de Sade, from whom we get the word sadistic, he was a thoroughgoing atheist, materialist, and he was a hedonist, although modern French philosophers of an atheistic nature are all arguing about whether he was not, and Foucault and the others are trying to rescue Sade from the horrors of how the world views him. He was a materialist. He said, "There is no God. Nature sufficeth unto herself. In no wise hath she need of an author." And a hedonist, "We are no guiltier in following the primitive impulses that govern us than is the Nile for her floods, or the sea for her waves. You don't have any free will, any will. You don't make any choices. It's just your nature. And if your nature is to be a rapist, go for it. If your nature is to be a pedophile, go for it. If your nature..." Whatever. It's like saying, well, the Nile shouldn't flood. To say a human shouldn't be into sadomasochism. If it's your nature, it's your nature. There's no morality. And so you see, here is a man who's between materialism and hedonism. He's down in that sector. Very different from the guru, isn't it? I mean, but it's a combination of these different dimensions in life that they have. The opposite, the materialist, the hedonist, really is a fairly easy one. What about these other two sectors? Who do you think would be an ascetic materialist? Or who do you think would be a spiritual hedonist? Anyone think of any ascetic materialists? Philosophies, people, concept? You're right, actually, yes. But I wouldn't think just extremes. I think basically the Green Party is over there, basically. That is, they are materialists. They're very worried about the world. It's a matter of great concern for them. Not everybody is atheistic materialists. Some of them are spiritual. But some of them are very materialistic in their attitudes and atheistic in their attitudes. However, they don't want us to enjoy the world. They want us to deny ourselves pleasures so that our grandchildren will still have a world to have. And so they are willing to make sacrifices of the standard of living and its pleasures in order to preserve the material world. Now, you have to be a very extreme one to be a full-blown ascetic materialist, but a lot of them are up in that sector, but not all of them, right, by all means. What about the other one? Can you think of any spiritual hedonists? We've insulted one group, let's go for another. John Piper, well, he writes books on hedonism, but then, of course, he redefines hedonism so that it's not really hedonism. Most cults, well, there are some cults that are, yes. The most common one I know is the New Age people, yes? Why do you think the New Age people? Because I said so, yes. Go on, tell us, yeah?
The New Age people are very spiritual. It's pretty easy to see that. But New Age spirituality is based in a world where it's about you. And so if the spirit and the world is all about you, then fundamentally you have to be hedonistic.
Yes.
You're not thinking of anyone else's pleasure.
No, that's right. That's quite right. And from a Christian morality point of view, New Age spirituality is not moral at all. Whatever your spirit leads you to enjoy is your spirituality. And so you do it. Okay. Now, to help us a little further in the understanding of it, I've asked our friends here to give us some quick talks about, they're very short talks, about some ancient and modern people. Two ancients, Epicureans and the Stoics. You need to know about them. Why? Why do you need to know? Well, you need to know everything, I know, but why do you particularly need to know the Epicureans and the Stoics? They're both in the Bible, that's right. When Paul preaches the gospel in Athens, he preaches to Stoics and Epicureans. So you've got to find out who they are. We don't have many of them these days, not technically like this. And so I picked a couple of moderns. Buddhism. Well, Buddhism's not modern, but it's just very widely used today. And utilitarianism, which is a 19th century movement, but is also very common today. Christianity is very different to all four. But that's what we've got to explore to some extent, you see. I mean, the idea of Stoicism and of Buddhism, that you avoid pain by detachment, by having no attachments, is the opposite of love, isn't it? Because love is all about attachment. And does it hurt? Yes. But do you choose not to love so as to avoid hurt? No. We love, and that does hurt, but that's what we're supposed to do, because God is love, and he is attached, so attached he sent his son to die for us. That is very painful. So these are very different philosophies, but they are still dealing with the issues that we have to deal with about the world itself. Now, I think your point is right. Rarely do you have people out on the end of the spectrum. You have a few, like the ones I've mentioned already, but generally people don't live out right at the end. Generally they kind of slide along somewhere. And because they're sliding along somewhere, we can get a different view of them. But I want to give, now they've got the basic idea, I'm going to make it more complicated for you. Are you ready? In a few minutes we'll have a mental break, so that's okay. But here we go. See, there are other dimensions than just these four. In fact, there's hundreds of other dimensions. I've just picked on kind of two dimensions, four positions, that are very different. But you see, there are some people who believe in poverty. I'm not talking about being poor, I'm saying they believe it's a good thing to be poor, and they believe it's a bad thing to be wealthy. Can you be a rich Christian? Or do riches exclude you from Christianity? Remember how Jesus said to the rich young ruler, easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven? Is that saying you can't be a rich Christian? That Christianity has to do with being poor? Or should be. Or again, there's whether you live as an individual or whether you think the community is more important. Which matters. See, there are some philosophies of life which are very, very individualistic, as we were talking about the New Age philosophy. But there are some which are really communalist. And sometimes it's all caught up together. So you can have a monk who lives out in the desert by himself. Or you can have a monk who lives in a monastery with other people. And there are some monks who live in a monastery where no one ever talks to anybody. A silent monastery. So you're in the community, but you don't commune. I mean, how important is community as opposed to the individual? How important is wealth as opposed to poverty, asceticism, hedonism? And you start to see that people are on four different spectrums or dimensions now. And like I say, we could spend all night just making more and more. There's 30, 40, 50 that you can think out if you really work on it. But I figured that was enough for our brains to be dealing with. And so you could map people in their kind of view of life. So that kind of person you see that we just had, they're by and large, they're community people, they're ascetic, they actually believe in poverty and spirituality. And so if you joined up all the kind of lines of different dimensions, it's that kind of person. Whereas the materialist, who's at the hedonist, they would be in this kind of sector of the Bible. So you could actually see different ways of understanding people and different ways of understanding the philosophies of life. And we're going to be looking about Christians and our relationship with the world. All so far is just laying the foundations for you, which are very tricky foundations, as you'll find out in a while too. So, but before we turn our mind to what's the Christian map look like, where do we fit in these dimensions, where would we put our little face up, before we do that, we're going to have a word from our sponsors. Thanks, Angus. Okay. I want us to read the Bible. Now, there's a novel idea for a Christian gathering, isn't it? And so I've got five of you lined up to read the Bible. If you'll turn in your Bibles to Mark chapter 2, Mark chapter 2. And yes, we're still on the same topic as beforehand, but beforehand we're setting the scene for the intellectual question that we're going to be answering in the next little while, although there's a twist in the tale, so just be warned. In Mark chapter 2, and I'll tell you the questions I want you to discuss in your group before you start reading it, so that when you're having it read to you, you'll be looking for the answers, all right? So there are different groups here. I want you to name the different groups in Israel, and then in what way is Jesus different to them all? And then why was Jesus different to John the Baptist? Because John's a true prophet. So how come the Messiah disagrees with the prophet who's a true prophet? So there's the questions we'll be doing on the way through this reading. So Mark chapter 2. Okay, when we walk out into the streets of Sydney, there is a multicultural city that we are in. And there's not just one view, there's lots and lots of views in our society of different groups and different peoples. Well, Jerusalem in the first century where Jesus was, lots of different views. Let's firstly just pick on some of the ones that we see in this passage. Where do you see, name one of them? The Pharisees. The Pharisees were the purists who kept the law or tried to keep the law as best they could with hundreds of rules and regulations, yes? The teachers of the law were usually Pharisees because the Pharisees had that penchant. They were the scribes, yes? The Herodians. Herod was the king in the area, but Herod was only a half-caste Jew, and he was a king because he was a puppet of the Romans. So whereas the Pharisees tried to be fanatically Jewish, the Herodians tried to keep on good terms with the Romans, and so therefore were not very Jewish at all, and very evil people, yes? Tax collectors and sinners, yes, tax collectors, they were collecting tax from the Jews to give to the Romans so the Romans could oppress the Jews. A tax collector was a traitor, thoroughly and completely, but more than a traitor, it was a money-grubbing exercise. They were very wealthy people because they had to bribe the Romans to give them the office of being tax collectors, yes? John's disciples, John the Baptist, gathered together a whole disciples. The whole nation was actually on edge with this man's preaching out near the waters, yes? Jesus' disciples, he started to gather them. Some of them used to be John's disciples, yes? Are we running out yet? The crowd, okay? There were the others, the hoi polloi, the rest, yes? Okay, any others that you got here? Yes, the sick, exactly. Now, what kind of sick do we know about here?
Paralyzed.
The paralyzed, yes? Yes, the man who's got a withered arm, yes. Which big group is not mentioned here? The Gentiles aren't, yes, you're only in Palestine. The lepers, yes, in the chapter 1 there's a leper, yes. Sadducees, that's right. The Sadducees do not believe, the Sadducees were often Herodians. They didn't believe in the resurrection. They tried to be more Greek than the Greeks. Greek was the dominant culture in the Roman world. A really highly educated Roman spoke Greek, didn't speak Latin. Greek was the language, you see. And the Sadducees tried to be as Greek as they could be, and the Herodians tried to be as Roman as they could be, and the Pharisees tried to be as legalistic as they could be. They all had different views, and their different views reflected in their different character. Now, in what way was Jesus different to them all?
Well, he didn't subscribe to any of the particular views. Like, he didn't call himself a Pharisee or a Sadducee or anything like
that. Yep, that's right. In what ways? We know his perfection, though you don't necessarily know from this passage, yes? He eats with tax collectors and sinners, which marks him out from the Pharisees, who wouldn't have anything to do with a tax collector and a sinner. And so they're criticised, yes? He heals and eats on the Sabbath. He has different views of the Sabbath than the Pharisees, yes? He forgives sins. Not everybody wants to be the forgiving of sins. But it's one thing, you see, for me to be able to forgive Ryan. Ryan, you're forgiven. It's okay. You all think now, Ryan must have done something wrong to Philip. Huh? But no, he's done nothing wrong to me. He's just a wrongdoer. I'm just forgiving him generally. Right? And then you've got to say, who does Philip think he is? He can forgive people of their sins when they're not sins against him. And so you see that with Jesus when the man comes down from the roof. Right? You're forgiven. Which then asks the question, well, who does Jesus think he is that he can forgive sins? You know, every now and then, by the way, some people say, how can things written 30 years later be remembered? Well, 30 years ago was 1992, and I can remember things in 1992. I suspect most of you can't remember, but you'll still know what happened in 1992. Anyone tell me anything that happened in 1992? The end of apartheid?
The Olympics.
The Olympics were at Barcelona, that's right. And they had a wonderful theme song, which I won't sing for you. There you go, the important things. You remember the big and important things, the things that were starting. Do you reckon if we were here and suddenly the roof opened and a man got lowered down, do you think you'd remember that 30 years later? You know, I think you'd be telling your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren, who'd be telling their grandchildren, wouldn't they? It's just that kind of thing. I've often wondered about the man being lowered down. You know, two of the ropes at the top, two of the ropes at the bottom. If the blokes at the bottom load the loads are faster than the blokes at the top, the paralysed man on his mat, never mind. So, here is an event that you would never forget. It's easier. But what was startling was Jesus missed his legs. Jesus went for the sins. And then when you stop and think about it, you think, well, hang on, who does he think he is? He forgives sins. See, Jesus is not like any of the others. At each one, he stands out as different. In fact, you can see how different they hate him. Chapter 3, verse 6, the Herodians, who get into bed with the Romans, and the Pharisees, who hate the Romans, join forces in their hatred of Jesus. Right? The National Party and the Greens get together to get rid of this person. I won't say which person, but I did point at you at the time. Now, there's the groups. Why was Jesus different to John the Baptist? Gentlemen, he was Lord of the Sabbath, yes. Although, yes, doesn't say bad about John. He's the bridegroom and John's the bride, is that it? No. What's the bridegroom got to do with it?
Well, there seems to be a distinction that Jesus makes about fasting because he's the bridegroom and others aren't.
He fasted, and what's the John the Baptist teaching about fasting? What's the difference between John and Jesus about fasting? Yeah, John fasts, Jesus feasts. That's a big difference. You know, you invite me to your place, I want feast. No, fast stuff. You know, don't invite me around for a fast. I want to eat. Right? And Jesus typifies it in terms of, I'm the bridegroom. Now, when the bride and groom are there at the wedding, what happens? Feasting, happiness, joy. When they leave, what happens? We all go home. The game's over. That is, the bridegroom is the life of the party. John the Baptist, he's no life of the party. He dresses in camel's hair and eats locusts, wild ones, and eats locusts, and he calls upon the nation to be baptized and tells them they're all going to hell. And he's no life of the party, he's the life of the fast, or the death thereof. Jesus is the life of the party. What's the difference? Huge, but why? Why are they so different? Well, it's got to do with being the bridegroom, and it's got to do with that funny thing about wineskins and cloths. Jesus is saying, not only am I the life of the party, but I'm bringing a completely new age, completely different thing. You can't just attach me into the system that is there. I'm not a Herodian, I'm not a Pharisee, I'm not a Sadducee. This is something new, completely new. A new age is coming with Jesus. Quickly then, draw your map. Where are you? Or where should you be? I don't care whether you talk about yourself or you talk about Christians. Where would you put Christians? Where's the little face or faces that you would put on those four dimensions that are listed there? Go for it quickly. Okay, who'd like to tell me where they think the Christians should be? Yes? Right smack in the middle. Yeah, okay. On the left upwards. So close to the centre and up. Yes, good. In the middle. Top leftish, yes? Yeah? Middle? Okay, well, like I say, you see, it's really important that we think and that we make mistakes, right? So that we can actually come to understand what it's about. Let me read to you, that you pick it up and read with me, will you please? Ecclesiastes chapter 3. For everything there's a season and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? I've seen the busyness that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He's made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. Time is what really matters. Whatever action happens, there's a time for the opposite action. There is a time for peace, but there's also a time for war. There is a time for love, and there is a time for hate. You know, if you read what Adolf Hitler did to the Jews and don't hate, there's something wrong with you. There's a time to hate. There's a time to love. There's a time to die and there's a time to live. There's a time for everything. And God has put in human hearts eternity. That is, we live outside this world and see this world. And we judge the timeliness of something because we're not like the animals. They don't have eternity in their hearts. They just munch the grass. There's a time for munching the grass and that's all they ever do. It's all the time they got. You see, they just keep it the same thing. Whereas we stand back and we think about whether it's this is the time for eating this or this is the time for eating that or this is the time not to eat or this is the time to have a feast. And it's our perception from eternity that gives meaning to the events of life. The events themselves are not meaningful. The meaning comes from outside, comes from our God-given task to see and understand when things should be. When John the Baptist came, it was the time to fast. But once Jesus came, it was the time to feast. Fasting is right, feasting is right, depending on the time. And so Jesus, you remember in Mark chapter 2 says, when I am taken away, when the bridegroom goes away, when I am taken away, referring to his cross, when that will be the time to fast. But as long as I'm with you, this is the time to feast. Now, here comes the ambivalence that we Christians have about the world today, isn't it? Because Jesus has been taken away from us again. And yet Jesus, by his Holy Spirit, is with us. So, do we feast? Do we fast because we're Christians? Well, it depends on the time that we're in. Because we're in both time zones, depending on... Come across to Revelation 21. Revelation 21, right towards the end of the Bible, of course. Revelation 21. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. See, we live in a world of tears. But the day is coming when we will live in a world where there are no tears. The tears of this world mean that we live in a certain pattern and way. The tearlessness of the world to come is what we look forward to. Christians have to understand that actually all this business is wrong. I've spent the evening telling you what you don't need to know. That's a relief, isn't it? I didn't understand it when you said it, Philip. Now I don't need to know it. Wasn't that good? No, you did need to know it because that's how people think. You may not have, but that's how most people think. And you can understand other people in those categories. But see, Christianity is different because Christianity is about something that happened in the past that is pointing forward to the future. We live in a time dimension. We live in a time dimension. And so our attitude to the world changes as it interfaces with the time dimension. I know it's tricky. This is the first week. You know, hang with me, kids. Hang with it. A few more weeks, you'll see more and more of it comes undone, come for us to understand what is happening to us so as to know how to live as a Christian in Sydney in the 21st century. But you can't start this way. You've got to start understanding that Jesus coming 2,000 years ago changes everything. And Jesus' return is going to change everything again. And we're living between these two, and we are changed because of it. You've heard of the prosperity gospel, I suppose, which of course is no gospel at all. There's a sense in which when the Lord Jesus returns, we will get full health, and we will get all the riches of heaven, and we will get justice at last. Health, wealth, justice are all good things when Jesus returns, not now. In this world, you're going to be sick, and we're not all going to be wealthy, and injustice is going to reign. Does that mean I don't want health, wealth, and justice? No, it means I do. Does that mean I don't work for them? It means I will. But I also know I'll never get them. It's never going to make a difference. No matter how healthy we all are, we're all going to die. And you never die of old age. I want to make this very clear to you. The older I get, the more I want you to understand. No one dies of old age. You always die of some organ failure in old age. But old age itself is not a disease. It's something very chic and attractive in this day and age. No, we're all going to die. We're all going to old. This is part of the world we're in. We're in a time dimension. And we need to understand the time dimension we're in if we're going to understand how we should be living now. Whether this is the moment for peace, or this is the moment for war, or this is the moment for love, or this is the moment for hate, or this is the moment because there is no just one thing that we always do.